everyone. Welcome. So I have just been informed of the program just now. Now I know what we have to do. So, but it's the usual program. So we're going to have a little bit of meditation first of all. Is that okay? Everybody okay with a bit of meditation like this? Yeah. Okay. Do a little bit of meditation first of all. Then we'll have a talk afterwards, and then we'll have some chance for a Q&A. So if you have some urgent questions, this is the opportunity here. And you can ask anything you want. Yeah, don't have to hold back. It's kind of nice to be able to ask everything you want. So don't be too afraid that you have to be super duper polite or anything like that. If I feel that it is not suitable, then it's okay. I'll just put it to one side. So please feel free to ask any kind of questions. But before we get to that, let's do some meditation together, just to get a bit of peace and quiet, which is always very useful. So as you start your meditation, it is always good to remind yourself that the purpose of meditation is to find a state of peace, a state of where you feel at ease and relaxed. And this is a very nice guidance for your entire meditation process. So start off by just sitting comfortably. It's only going to be a short meditation, but still to be comfortable and at ease. And then when you close your eyes, you can feel your body and feel your mind. And the purpose really is just to relax and to be at ease, first of all. And make sure that you approach the meditation with the right kind of attitude, with a sense of gentleness towards yourself, because that gentleness will allow you to really relax, to let go of any stress or any tension you may have. So just start off by feeling the body, being kind towards yourself, and allowing yourself to relax properly. And it is important to relax 100% before you move on in your meditation practice, that you really feel at ease where you are. And once you start feeling at ease, it is important to have this attitude of being a passive observer in your meditation, like a passenger on a train, like someone who is not involved, someone who is holding back and just allowing the world to flow by. And as you do this, it is as if you are standing back from all the phenomena of the world, just allowing things to flow by, as if you have no attachment or nothing, no involvement in those things. There's no judgment about what is right and wrong. There's just an observation of things coming and going. And if you can do this, it is already a nice state of mindfulness. And if you find yourself thinking during the meditation, thinking about the things of the world, remember that the world really doesn't hold anything of interest. The world is so unreliable and uncertain, always letting us down. And the only true refuge is within, inside. So turn your attention inside instead. Let go of that unstable world outside, which is always so full of problems. And please feel that beautiful peace inside that comes from letting go of all the things of the world, letting go of all the burdens in life, that beautiful sense of emptiness and peace inside that you find as a consequence. It's important to notice the beauty of meditation practice, and then your mind will incline in that direction. And we are now coming close to the end of the meditation. And before we come to the end, I'll ask you to please ask yourself how you feel now. And if you feel a little bit more relaxed and at ease, a little bit more mindful than you did when you started, ask yourself why that is the case. How does this process of meditation work? Okay, so that is the end of the meditation for now. Okay, everyone, so welcome. And the talk for today is titled, I think, The Easy Way to Awakening. That sound good? Sounds good. It's all about marketing. Yeah, marketing is really what it's all about. So you have to, this is one of the things about being a Buddhist monk, is that one of the things that you have to do is to kind of teach Buddhism. And of course, whenever you teach something, there's always some degree of marketing involved. And that's just the name of the game, because otherwise, if you talk about Buddhism in the wrong way, if you travel to the West and you start talking about Nibbana straight away, then they don't get it. They don't understand. You have to start simpler things and then build it up. It's always about presenting the Dhamma in a good way. It's so important. So the easy way to awakening. What is that easy way to awakening? There's only one way to awakening. It's because only one way. That is both the easy way, the intermediate way, and the difficult way. All ways is the only way. And that only way to awakening is the Noble Eightfold Path. And it is important to remember that very often in the history of Buddhism, you see how people come up with new ways, new paths to awakening. Yeah, new ideas about how to get to Nibbana quickly, because Eightfold Path seems to take so long. Yeah, sometimes it seems like we're not making much progress or whatever, and then we want to find the fast way. So we chop off one factor and we do the Sevenfold Path instead. The problem is that the Sevenfold Path may look easier, but the problem is it doesn't lead to awakening. That's just the tiny drawback. Yeah, actually, pretty major drawback, actually, to be honest, but you know what I mean. Or you chop off right view, because right view is not always so popular. Yeah, people think, yeah, right view, okay, this kind of ancient ideas that came from ancient India, we can't believe in these things in the modern world, so you chop off right view. So now you get left with six factors. And then they think, yeah, all this virtue or whatever. Yeah, actually, it's a hassle to keep virtue. You know, you can't really be free, you can't really relax properly, you can't enjoy yourself if you have to keep all these precepts. Throw away the precepts. So then what are we left with? Well, ultimately, all you're left with is mindfulness. And that's what you see in the West now. You see mindfulness everywhere. And Buddhism has been reduced to one thing, one factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, mindfulness. Where is it going to get you? Not very far. And this is one of those problems, is that when we try to reduce things, when we try to change things, actually, we throw out the baby, we keep the bathwater. Not much point in having the baby is the Noble Eightfold Path. So this is so important, and I know that there is always in Buddhist circles, wherever you travel around the world, there's always people who come up with the easy paths. Yeah, they have discovered the easy way. Everyone is becoming a stream mentor, a sovan. I know two or three Sinhala works. One of them is sovan. Not very much, but I know some of the kind of significant things. So, and easy way, yeah, everyone is becoming Sotapanna. So this is where we should go. We should all practice under that system. Yeah, they have found a special technique, a shortcut through samsara. And this is such a common thing. I heard this so many times through my monastic life. I've been a Buddhist monk now for almost 25 years. And you hear about these things all the time. And I would like to say at the very start of this talk that if you hear about a shortcut, be very, very skeptical. Chances it is not a shortcut at all. It is more like the long cut. don't take the long cut. Yeah, the long cut keeps on going, 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 round and round, and you never actually come to any end. So don't go for the long cut. Go for the shortcut. The shortcut is the Noble Eightfold Path. So that is the starting point of this talk. So just getting clarity about what we should look for when we look in this Buddhist practice. But of course, practice in the Noble Eightfold Path is not always so obvious. What we actually have to do, how can we make this Noble Eightfold Path work for us so it actually happens, yeah, so it actually comes out. What are the ways of looking at this path so as to make it powerful and useful and actually becomes a source for happiness and goodness in our lives? And sometimes we have kind of have these eight factors and we think about them. We think, what should I focus on? How should I kind of balance these factors out? Should I be mindful all the way through the day? And if I'm mindful, how should I use that kind of mindfulness? What kind of virtue should I look at? How do we actually make all of these things work in such a way that it becomes powerful for us? And this is what I want to have a look at today. It's based on one of the suttas of the Buddha. Usually when I give talks, I usually talk from the suttas. Tipitaka, actually not the Tipitaka, more like the Ekapitaka. You know the difference between the Tipitaka and Ekapitaka? Tipitaka is three pitakas. Yeah? Ekapitaka is one pitaka. I always focus on one. I leave two aside. Is that bad? Maybe not. Maybe it's a good thing. Maybe we should focus on the word of the Buddha. And that's what I try to do. What is most likely to be the word of the Buddha? That's found mostly in the Ekapitaka. Even the Ekapitaka has to be kind of, you know, cut down a little bit because even that is too much. So more like the half Ekapitaka. What is that? Adde Ekapitaka? Something like that? Adde Ekapitaka. You have to know Pali really well to be able to say these things. I think it's Adde Eka, something like that in Pali. Doesn't matter. We don't need to know the Pali words. So we come back to these suttas, and this particular sutta that I want to base the talk on tonight is found in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the chapter on tens, number 61 and 62. So after this talk, please go back and check it out. Make sure I haven't tricked you into believing what is the word of the Buddha actually is not the word of the Buddha, or the other way around, whatever it is. Always good to check these things up. So this particular sutta, it shows the way to awakening here. It starts at the very top with awakening, and awakening is called in the sutta Vijja Vimutti. These are two words in the Pali language, which means like insight and liberation, basically. And that is what awakening is all about. Yeah? So one way of looking at awakening here. And then what it does, this sutta, very beautifully, it traces back the causes of awakening, stage by stage, all the way back down to the original cause, the most basic cause that makes awakening possible. Do you know what that cause is? Does anyone here know what that cause is? Anyone? What about those of you who have listened to my talks before? Can you know what that cause is? Some of you probably do. Nobody knows. Okay, so it's the right talk for you. Yeah, you're in the right place because now you're about to find out. It's exciting, isn't it? We want to go to awakening. We want to go to the very highest point of the Buddhist path, and we want to bring it back to the root cause that makes awakening possible. Isn't that kind of exciting? I don't know, I think it's quite exciting and quite interesting, because if you know the root cause, and you know that these causes, these conditions, they support each other all the way to awakening, if you get the root cause right, the rest of the path kind of arises as a consequence. That is exciting, isn't it? Because what it means is that if all you have to do is focus on that root cause, then it is quite easy to know what you have to do in this life, how to practice, so that gradually you actually gain that awakening for yourself. And this is what I mean by the easy way here. Draw it down to one, some very simple, specific causes that support the entire path. And once you understand that, once you practice that, things tend to happen as a consequence. So quite exciting. And I must admit, one of the things that I love about reading the word of the Buddha, that it has full of little gems like this. Gems that opens up the way to look at the Dhamma. Gems that show you the Dhamma through similes and metaphors and little stories and all these kind of things. And that bring out the essence of these teachings in such a powerful and beautiful way. And this is why I love the suttas of the Buddha. They are so powerful. people think that talks in the modern world, you come to listen to a talk here, listen to a talk there, you read a book about Buddhism. Yeah, everyone does that. And everyone thinks that it's easier to read these books and listen to these talks than it is to go back to the word of the Buddha. Actually, it's the other way around. If you really get into the Dhamma, if you really want to understand what the Dhamma is about, the most consistent, the most clear, the most powerful teachings in the world come directly from the Buddha himself. The suttas is where you find the best teachings. Sometimes you may think that modern teachings are kind of nice and they feel good and all of these kind of things. But if you try to fully understand what the path is about, and you start to read these things, you realize it doesn't really give you that overview. The language is often ambiguous and uncertain. You don't really know what it means. The more in depth you try to read these things, the less sense they often make. With the word of the Buddha, it's the exact opposite. The more you read it, the more you study it, the more it comes out and the more powerful it is. So one of my jobs as a Buddhist monk is to inspire you to take more interest in the word of the Buddha, because this is the gold standard for what is Buddhism in this world. So we start with awakening and we go backwards. Awakening is vijja vimutti in the sutta. What is awakening here? And awakening, there's many different ways you can look at the idea of awakening. You can say that awakening is the attainment of the highest happiness. Yeah, some people say the end of dukkha or suffering, which is nice, but attainment of the highest happiness, I think, is better. Yeah, we have to sell Buddhism in the right way again. If I'm a bad salesman, just let me know, because I'm trying here to really my very best to sell it to you. If I don't succeed, I feel really ashamed after this talk. Yeah. So let me know if I succeed or not. So this is one way of thinking about it, the idea of the highest happiness. Yeah, and this is certainly awakening experience. Another way is to think of it as becoming awake. It lies in the word awakening. The word bodhi in Pali means to become awake. It doesn't necessarily mean understand. Actually, the root meaning is awake rather than understanding. So you are awake. You suddenly one day you see things clearly. It's as if the veil has been drawn away. The curtain that hid the reality of existence has been drawn back. And suddenly you see reality for what it actually is. It's like you're waking up from a dream. You have been slightly dreaming all your life. And then one day, bang, wow, this is what it's like. And you gain mindfulness for the first time in your life, fully, fully in the present moment, and you see clearly what is there and what is not there. That is a beautiful metaphor, to become awake, to see existence properly. It's a wonderful thing of this idea of awakening. But there is another idea of awakening which people sometimes don't talk about, and that is that awakening, what it really is, in a very profound sense, it is this discovery here of the answer to the meaning of life itself. Awakening is not just waking up to something. It's not just a kind of happiness that you have. It is actually finding the answer to the meaning of life itself. That is so powerful when you think about it. It's extraordinary. We have had 2,500 years since the time of the Buddha. We've had even more time before that. Throughout all of known history, philosophers, religious people, everyone have been trying to understand the idea of the meaning of life. How many people have come up with a realistic answer to the meaning of life? Philosophers have been scratching their head. Religious people have been trying to meditate without the same success as the Buddha. And they have never come up with a satisfactory answer. After a while, the philosophers, they give up. They say, it's too difficult. Yeah, throw it out. Too difficult. Let's think about something easier, like, mathematical equations, that kind of thing. Much easier. Yeah, differential equations, far easier than the meaning of life. So let's focus on those differential equations. Some of you probably studied differential equations at university. Yeah, they can get quite complicated. That's the easy part. The hard part is the meaning of life. And this is what this man, we call the Buddha, discovered 2,500 years ago. It really is something extraordinary. And when you get that, you start to understand what a remarkable spiritual genius the Buddha was. He is kind of the towering figure in the spiritual world in human history. He stands head and shoulders above everyone else because he has discovered what everyone in this world is looking for. The answer to the meaning of life itself. Why is that? And the answer is that If you look inside of yourself and you see what life is like, life is always a movement towards something here. We are driven by desires and cravings, always moving towards something here. And that's something that we are trying to move towards. We never arrive at it. We never get there. Craving begets more craving here. Craving doesn't really lead to any real contentment and satisfaction. It just keeps on going and going and going here. Craving tells you, if you get this, you will be happy. You get this wonderful relationship, yeah. You get a new boyfriend or girlfriend or whatever it is. You get the right job. You get the right kind of material possessions. Then you'll be okay here. But of course, it carries on. And it carries on. And it carries on. And we've already been doing this for far too long. It's time to listen to the Buddha. And this is what the Buddhist path does. Craving was promising all along where you're going to get if you follow the promise of craving. Finally, you find that through the Buddhist path. Craving dies down. You find the inner happiness in a very, very powerful way until the point comes. You are completely content and happy. You feel like this rock in your meditation practice. You don't want to do anything else in the whole world. There's no reason to move anymore. Why? Because you have found what you're looking for. And this is what the Buddha gives you. It's extraordinarily powerful, this very meaning of life, this drive that we have towards something that is always with us has died down, and we have filled that psychological itch inside of us that always drives us, is gone, and we are satisfied. It's an amazing thing. Please reflect on that, because once you understand this, you understand the extraordinary power of these Buddhist teachings. They really are exceptional. It is literally about the meaning of life itself. So how do we find this meaning of life? This is what I'm supposed to talk about, the cause and conditions that lead to the discovery of the meaning of life. And in this particular sutta, it says that the cause for discovering this is what is known in Pali as the Satta Sambojanga. Many of you will probably know about this already, because one of the nice things about coming to Sri Lanka, this is one of the wonderful things about Sri Lanka, you talk Pali words, you talk about the suttas, and everyone is really happy about it. It's wonderful. Yeah, this is one of the great reasons for coming to Sri Lanka and giving a few talks and sharing Dhamma, because all of you, most of you, you think a little bit like me already, yeah, which is wonderful. So we have something in common, and that is great. The Satta Sambojanga, the seven factors of awareness. Awakening here. These are the things that lead to awakening here. What are these things? And these things are all about samadhi practice. Samadhi is one of the factors of these seven factors, and all of the other ones are supporting factors for samadhi to happen here. So samadhi is the cause for awakening. Samadhi is the cause for attaining, understanding, coming to the conclusion of what the meaning of life is all about. Very interesting. And this is something, the more you read the suttas, the more you understand the word of the Buddha, the more you see that this is actually what it is like all the way throughout the word of the Buddha. Samadhi is a requirement for understanding the very meaning of life. Very significant, because it is often underestimated on the Buddhist path. Yeah, we talked about before the sevenfold path, maybe without samadhi, but no, samadhi is fundamental for reaching this awakening here. And one of the reasons for that is because samadhi gives you a taste of that very thing here. When you go to a very deep, still state inside of you, we can maybe translate samadhi as stillness. Never translate samadhi as concentration. Do you promise that? Yeah, can you promise? Okay, good. Okay. If you have heard Ajahn Brahm talk about this, anyone here who has not heard of Ajahn Brahm? Everyone has heard of Ajahn Brahm. Okay, good. So then you are ready. Again, we are on the same. We're on the same kind of wavelength here. That's good. Don't say concentration, because concentration is very misleading. So say stillness instead. Concentration means force, power. Stillness means peace and ease. A very different idea. If you become very peaceful and very still, and the craving dies down completely, you get a foretaste of what the meaning of life is all about. Because the samadhi experience is very similar to the awakening experience in that sense. You just take it further. And the samadhi empowers your ability to be able to see these deep truths of the Dhamma. So samadhi is essential. Please keep that in mind. Don't forget that. Whenever you open the suttas, you will see the truth of this, because it really is everywhere in the suttas. And samadhi is very interesting, because when you see samadhi in practice, what you see is something quite remarkable. And I heard a story some time ago. This was you may have heard, there's a monastery in Thailand called Wat Nanachat. Wat in Thailand is like the local word for monastery. And Nanachat, Nana is like the Pali word Nana, which is many, and Chat is like nations or something like that. So like the international monastery or something like that, many nation monastery here. And this monastery was actually started by a number of Western monks. And one of the monks who helped start in this monastery was Ajahn Brahm. He was one of the initiators of this monastery here. And they would have meetings in this monastery. So they would come together for meditation in the evening on the Uposatha days, the fortnightly moon days. They would come together and they would sit all night. And one of these days in this monastery here, all the local villagers would come and they would all meditate together, and the monks would all be sitting on an asana, just a bit like here, a kind of raised platform, maybe not quite high as this one, but a similar kind of thing, and all the villagers would be there in front, and they would all meditate together here. And some of these villagers, the old Thai ladies, this was before these days Thailand is getting too comfortable like most places, but in those days it was still very simple. This was like the mid-1970s. There was very little economic development in Thailand, very simple, everyone sitting on the floor, that's what they were used to. So these Thai ladies, the old ones, they were so tough, super tough ladies. They could sit there for hours. I don't know if they had any good meditation, but they could sit there on the floor for hours just out of pure endurance. And some of them may also have had really good meditation, by the way. There obviously was a mix. But these old Thai ladies, super duper tough. The monks were nothing compared to the Thai ladies. And so they would sit there in the hall, and they would meditate all night. And after many hours, some of the monks and some of the lay people started to move out. They would leave the hall. And more would leave until, when you get late in the night, there was less and less people there, until very late in the night, only two people left in that hall. One of them was Ajahn Brahm. The other one was the toughest of all the tough Thai ladies, sitting there in front of him in the hall on the floor. And this old Thai lady, she was observing Ajahn Brahm. She was looking at him. And as she was looking at Ajahn Brahm, she couldn't see anything moving. There was no sign of any movement in the body. The body was completely still. There was no sign of any breath. And as I like to say, even it was so still that even the mosquitoes were confused. Why? Because have you seen this before? It's very interesting. If someone is absolutely still, the mosquitoes, they need some kind of indication that you are there. Otherwise, they don't know whether it's a tree or a rock or a human being. But when you're so still, it is like you are a rock. You're like a tree. So the mosquitoes is unsure. So it goes round and round and round and round and never settles down. So if you want to get rid of the mosquitoes and you don't want to get dengue fever or whatever, samadhi is the path. That's an additional advantage of samadhi. People don't know about that one. Additional benefit of samadhi. So she is looking at Ajahn Brahm, and he's absolutely still. No breath, no movement, no nothing, absolutely nothing. 1 hour goes by, 2 hours goes by. And then after 2 hours, 3 hours, she gets up out of the hall. She goes outside of the hall, finds the nearest monk, and she says to the nearest monk, "There's a monk sitting in the hall, he's dead." That is samadhi for you. This shows you the power of samadhi. It gives an idea, and the reason why you can have that stillness is because you have given up all desire and craving. There's nothing in you that moves you anymore, to the point where everything dies down and you become literally like a rock. You become indistinguishable from a rock pretty much, because nothing is moving in you. And you look like you are dead. But if you touch, still warm. How's that possible? You're dead and warm at the same time. Okay, maybe not. Maybe after all, not. Oops, I'm messing up my microphone here. I apologize. So always. These are the kind of the marvels of samadhi, and these kind of the things. When you see these things, you realize something very powerful is going on. You see these things a few times, and you realize there is a degree of contentment, happiness, if you like, stillness available in this world that is beyond, way, way beyond the normal. And this already starts to also to give rise to a bit of faith and confidence in this Buddhist path, when occasionally you might see these sort of things. Anyway, samadhi. What is the cause of samadhi here? I promised I was going to take you back stage by stage. What is the cause of samadhi? And this sutta says the cause of samadhi is the four satipatthanas. Satipatthana. Four of them. Why is that? How does that work? And the way this works that is that the main way that satipatthana is explained in the suttas, you have the satipatthana sutta, of course, but the satipatthana sutta, if you read it, it's not very clear exactly what you have to do. Yeah, it says contemplate the feelings, contemplate the mind, but what is the context? How do we actually do this? And the place where it is described how to do this is in the Anapanasati Sutta. That is where you find, and in the Anapanasati Sutta it says, if you practice the mindfulness of breathing in the right way, it fulfills all the four satipatthanas. It is all you have to do, really, to do satipatthana practice, is to focus on the breath. Makes it quite simple. Yeah, make it as simple as possible. I said the easy path, so now I'm trying to kind of bring things down to the bare minimum to make it as simple as possible. So all you really have to do is to watch the breath. If you watch the breath properly, you will fulfill the four satipatthanas. If you fulfill the four satipatthanas, everything else also falls into place. It's one of those remarkable things about the Buddhist path. It is so natural in a way. Very fit, you know, the breath is such a natural principle, and all you have to do is to be with this humble little thing in our life, the breath, and that can take you all the way to awakening. The Buddhism is actually very simple. Very simple teaching. If, of course, if you scratch your head too much about dependent origination, etc., then you're gonna, might get a headache even, but actually the basic principles of the path, really, really simple, and really, really straightforward. All you have to do is watch the breath. Actually, it's not quite true, because you have to investigate a bit, yeah, you have to see what is stopping you from going further, yeah, and all of these things. So it's not just watching the breath, of course. It takes more than that. It takes a bit of vipassana, of insight. You bring that along with your meditation. But essentially, it is watching the breath that takes you all the way to awakening this way. Huh? So very simple. So watching the breath, satipatthana, seven factors of awakening, and then awakening itself. So what is the support? What is it that gives rise to satipatthana practice of watching the breath? And now it starts to get very interesting. Because what the Buddha says, the thing that supports your ability to watch the breath is the Tini Sucharitani, I think it's called, the three ability to watch the breath. And this is basically what sila is about. Three kinds of good conduct. And this is very interesting, because what this means, very often when you go on meditation retreats or you get questions from people about meditation, very often they will ask you, my meditation isn't going so well. What am I doing wrong? How should I look at the breath? Am I using the wrong kamatana? Am I not sitting long enough? Should I start it another way? They ask you all these technical questions about how meditation should be done. But there is very little technique. Yeah, it's only watching the breath. There's not much technique to be done. It's just watching the breath for... No, I shouldn't say that. It's only watching the breath. Yeah, it's very, very simple. So because of that, that is not the problem. If you're not succeeding in your meditation practice, the problem is not that you're using the wrong kamatana. The problem is not that you're watching the breath in the wrong way. How can you watch the breath in the wrong way? It's just in, out. It can't get much simpler than that. True, right? Yeah, it's very simple. So all you have to do is watch it. So there isn't much technical things going on. So if your meditation isn't working, the answer why it isn't working, you find right in this sutta, it means that your good conduct has not been developed enough yet to a high enough level to enable you to attain the mindfulness that makes watching the breath possible. That is all there is to it. So if you are having problems in your meditation practice, I don't know how you went just now, if you enjoyed it or not, but if you're having problems, that is where the problem lies, and that is where you need to look. But remember that sila in Buddhism is a very profound thing. Usually we talk about the panchasila, the five precepts. But of course, sila in Buddhism is much more than that. And in particular, the Tini Sucharitani are much more, as a very broad development of conduct in the right way. You can say it has to do with your very character, who you are as a person. All of these things come into this. It's a very, very broad thing, what we call sila in Buddhism. So if you want to find out if your meditation isn't working right, you need to look at this broad field of factors. Okay. Bodily conduct, yeah, you have to avoid doing the bad things. Speech, you have to avoid doing the wrong speech. Even that can be quite hard. Yeah, avoiding wrong speech all the time, quite difficult. Someone is nodding, that is good. It means you understand what I'm talking about. It can be quite hard, especially in the hustle and bustle of ordinary life. Suddenly you get into a difficult situation, and before you know it, something has come out of your mouth. You want to put it back in again, but too late. Can't put it back in again. This is the problem. Once the words are out, that's it. So you need, and this is why these things are quite hard. But it gets even harder, because not only should we do that, but we should also avoid the wrong kind of thinking. Yeah, we should avoid getting angry, if possible. We should avoid excessive greed, if possible. And the last one is even the most important one, in many ways the most interesting one, is the idea of right view. Because right view is also one of the sucharitanis, one of the right conducts, according to Buddhism. And not only this, but we need to do the opposite. Not only should we avoid the bad actions, we should do the good actions. Not only should we avoid the bad speech, we should do the good speech. Every time you open your mouth, you have the possibility of giving the people around you a gift of good speech, a gift of kindness, something that goes to their heart. Isn't that wonderful? Remember that, yeah? Every time you open your mouth, you have the possibility of giving the people around you a gift of speech. If you speak kindly to the people around you, according to the four ways of right speech, not lying, creating harmony in the world with gentleness and also not frivolous chattering. If you talk in that way, you're actually giving people a gift every time you open your mouth. Isn't that a wonderful thing? And imagine the potential for giving gifts if every time you open your mouth you're going to speak. The potential is almost endless because we do talk quite a bit. So this way of looking at the Dhamma, this way of thinking about it, actually opens up the potential for kindness, for generosity in an entirely new way. And it makes your practice far more powerful as a consequence. So do the good actions, do the good speech, and lastly, think the right kind of thoughts. Think thoughts of kindness, think thoughts of compassion, and then you're on the right track. Think thoughts of right view, and then everything starts to come together. So this is pretty demanding. But if you really want your meditation to come together, it is not usually enough just to keep your five precepts. You have to expand out and do much more than that, to the point where you actually purify yourself in a very deep way. So this is the teeny sucharitani, the three kinds of right conduct. Please remember that. This is so powerful and so important. So much of the Buddhist path really happens right there in your ability to live in the good and the right way. That is really the holy grail of meditation. Holy grail is a Christian idea, but sometimes we can use Christian terms, right? We can mix a little bit. The holy grail of Buddhist meditation is found in the right conduct in this way here. I don't mean to offend any Christians. I hope you don't mind me using your terminology a little bit. Thank you very much for allowing me. That's kind of brotherly love between the Christians and the Buddhists. So what then is the support of these three rites of good conduct? And the Buddha says there is a number of factors that come in here. One of the factors is indriya sangvara sila, the conduct of restraint of the senses. One of them is sati sampajanya, mindfulness and full awareness, clear comprehension, something like that. And the next one is yoniso manasikara. You have the wise attention, looking at things in the right way. So I know all of you know these words already. At least most of you, yeah, which is kind of nice. That's why I like to say the Pali terms, because then we have something in common. I don't trust these English translations. Do you trust them? Yeah, kind of. Sometimes a bit dodgy. Yeah, you come back to the basics, come back to the Pali, sometimes better. So these are the three things. And of these three things, these really come down to yoniso manasikara. That's why I'm not going to talk about all of them, because we haven't got all night, so I'm going to kind of cut down a little bit. So it comes down to yoniso manasikara, which means wise attention. It means looking at things, attending to things in the right way. When you see another person, you have a choice. When you look at someone, you can look at their good qualities, or you can look at their bad qualities. If you look at the bad qualities of another person, anger will arise. or can arise. It doesn't have to arise, but it can arise. Or, alternatively, you can look at the good qualities, and then you feel a sense of friendliness. You feel a sense of metta, maitri, even, when you do that. And that is the difference between yoniso manasikara, right or good attention, and ayoniso manasikara, wrong attention. That is the difference. That's all you have to do. It's very simple. It's simple, but not easy. Yeah, shift your attention from looking at other people around you, looking at the good qualities rather than the bad qualities. And as you do that, actually, you're changing your entire outlook, and then you are moving forward, and you're establishing these three rites of good conduct as a consequence. That is the most important one of the yoniso manasikara, looking at other people in the right way. Because so much of our anger, disappointment, frustration, and irritation in this world comes through the way we deal with other people. How we deal with other people is so important, so fundamental to whether we have success on this Buddhist path or not. So, yoniso manasikara. In general, it is much broader than that, but yoniso manasikara can be defined in general, and if you want to look it up, you want to look it up. Okay, if anyone here wants to look it up, go to the second sutta of the Majjhima Nikaya, known as the Sabhasana Sutta. Go there, and then you can check out my words afterwards. And if I have said something wrong, you can send me an email and tell me off. Yeah, some of the organizers here will probably give you my email address. You can tell me off. If you want to tell me off for something wrong, it's worthwhile sending an email. Otherwise, you cannot send me an email. So what does it say in the Savasana Sutta? It says that whenever you attend in such a way that your good qualities grow, whenever you attend in such a way that your bad qualities decline, then you are attending in the right way. So you can know this throughout your day, whether you are attending in the right way or not. Are your good qualities getting established and growing? Are your bad qualities going down? And if that is happening, you are attending in the right way. This is one of those beautiful things that I found so important when I was reading the suttas, reading the word of the Buddha. It's such a powerful way of knowing whether you're heading in the right direction or not. Look at your life over a period of time, 6 months, 3 months, a year, whatever it is, and look and see if the good qualities are getting established in you and the bad qualities are going down. Is your mindfulness increasing? Is your heart becoming more pure? Are you feeling more kind to people in the world in general? Are you becoming a more generous person towards everyone around you? Are your bad qualities, your anger going down a little bit, your greed going down a little bit? And if you see that happening over the long term, then you are heading in the right direction, and this whole path will work as a consequence. It's a very beautiful little a rule of thumb to help us in the right direction. And if this isn't happening, if you're not actually moving in the right direction, if good qualities are not increasing, bad qualities are increasing perhaps, that's bad. Bad quality increasing is bad. So be careful. Then you have to look, and you have to investigate yourself, and you have to ask if you are going wrong somewhere on the path. And sometimes you have to be brutally honest with yourself to see where you're going wrong, so you can get back on this path again and head in the right direction. Yoniso manasikara. Where does that come from? It comes from saddha, shraddha, I think you call it in Sinhala, faith, confidence, inspiration, something like that. And this is actually one of those very interesting things in Buddhism, is that yoniso manasikara is a kind of wisdom. It's the wisdom of knowing how to attend to the world and to the people around you. Where does that wisdom come from? It comes from faith. How can wisdom come from faith? Isn't faith the opposite of wisdom? Well, in some teachings it is, but not in Buddhism. This is one of the interesting things about the Buddhist teaching, is that faith and wisdom are two sides of the same coin. The more wisdom you have, the stronger is your saddha. It is. Why is that? Well, the more confidence you have in those teachings at the same time. And that is why confidence is a nice translation of the word saddha. Or faith also is also nice. Why is faith nice? Faith is nice because saddha also means emotion. It means positive emotion. Yeah, you feel, wow, jeepers, these teachings are just awesome. And then, I have to use a bit modern vocabulary just to kind of make it fit in with modern times. These teachings are so wonderful. Marvelous. And then the faith, when you get that beautiful feeling inside that you are in the presence of something very wonderful, that is a very important part of sadhā, that emotion that comes up with that confidence and with that faith. Because that emotion actually has one of the powers to drive you forward on the path, because you are inspired by these teachings. And the positive emotions are also the emotions that enable you access to meditation and samadhi and all of these things. So sadhā has these two qualities, and it is very closely related with wisdom, which is kind of interesting. So how do we give rise to this sadhā in Buddhism? And I will give you a couple of examples, because it is actually not very all that difficult. The main thing, of course, is to come into contact with the Buddhist teachings and actually understand them and really see that they apply to your life, to see how powerful they are, and to see the amazing thing that the Buddha, he taught 2,500 years ago. These teachings have traversed a very long time span of 2,500 years. They have gone from the culture of ancient India to modern Sri Lanka, to the Western world. Basically everywhere around the world you find these teachings now. There are monasteries in Uganda. I know a Ugandan monk. Yeah, in Africa itself, now Buddhism is kind of also happening. This Ugandan monk I've met on a few conferences occasionally. So everywhere it is going. Yeah, I'm not sure about Antarctica. I think that might be the only place where there isn't much Buddhism. You would have to convert the penguins, I think, to get Buddhism in Antarctica. There's so few people down there. That probably is not going to happen. I think we have to give up on Antarctica, but everywhere else we have Buddhism. So it is going out everywhere. And that is because of these people getting faith in these teachings and also faith in some of the teachers that are around. Both of these things come together and give rise to this shraddha. So just to give you some examples of what I'm talking about a year and a half ago or something like that, I went to Thailand. I go to Thailand occasionally. I travel a little bit around the Buddhist world, many different places occasionally. And occasionally I like to meet some of the teachers that I'm aware of who live in these countries. And some of them are very inspiring and very interesting. And I went to meet this one teacher. And he's actually a good friend of Ajahn Brahm as well. He has stayed in our monastery before. So I went to visit him. And then when I went to visit him, I wanted to ask him some questions. You always want to ask questions of these teachers. You always think that they're going to give you some magic formula, but they never do. That is kind of it's interesting, isn't it? You think they're going to have some magic formula, but of course they don't. This is what is actually very fascinating about this. And I'll give an example of that in a second. I went to him, so I go, and he's a very senior monk, so you go there, you bow down, and then you sit down, and then you kind of watch him in action. He doesn't teach very much. I'll give you an example of how he doesn't teach very much. We had a whole group coming from Perth in Australia. That is where I live, in case you don't know. That's where Ajahn Brahm's monastery is. That's where I live as well. We had a whole group, and they went to this monk's monastery. His name is Ajahn Ganha. And they went to his monastery, and they thought, yeah, now we have the real meditation master. We get some real meditation teachings. Yeah, none of that kind of Ajahn Brahm jokes, but real meditation teachings. Actually, Ajahn Brahm's jokes are not to be taken too lightly here. But anyway, let's just stick with this one before I get sidetracked onto something else. They think, wow, we got to meet this meditation teacher. What a wonderful opportunity to ask really profound questions on meditation. So this whole group comes together, they assemble around this monk, everyone really anticipating these wonderful answers they're going to get. They ask him, Venerable Sir, how do we meditate? What is your kind of preferred way of doing meditation? And they settle down for a long talk, yeah? And then this monk says, breathe in, sabai. Sabai means relax, yeah? Breathe out, sabai. End of Dhamma talk, yeah? It's interesting, isn't it? So simple, so basic, and often that is all we require really to make progress on this path. It doesn't have to be very complicated. Often the simple teachings are the most profound ones because they can be understood. It's easy to understand. Everyone understands, relax, breathe in, relax, breathe out, relax. Very straight to the point. And that is often how some of these teachers that I have met that are the most impressive, how they are. Simple people who, not necessarily even simple people, they can be very complicated or intelligent in many ways, but the way they express the Dhamma is straight to the point. Yeah, no messing around. So I sit down in the presence of this monk, And I watch him, you know. As I said, he doesn't say very much. I've already shown you why. What I mean by he doesn't say very much. He sits there and he smiles. And he's like a magnet. People come from everywhere, from around the world. Yeah, from Malaysia, from Singapore. I don't know, from Sri Lanka, probably from Sri Lanka as well. From Europe, from the US, from Australia, from everywhere. And they're drawn like a magnet to this monk. And when you watch this, it's very strange. Because usually you think that, well, if you're drawn like a magnet, it's because he has something to tell you. He doesn't have anything to say. He just sits there and smiles. And you realize the reason why people are drawn to him is because of the metta, the kindness, the peace, and all the good qualities that you feel in the presence of this person. You just want to sit there. You want to bathe in kind of in the peace and the presence of this monk. That's all you want to do. Kind of nice, isn't it? You just sit there, you relax, you close your eyes, and suddenly your meditation is deeper than it has ever been before, simply because you can relax properly for the first time. So he sits there, he doesn't do very much. All these people are sitting around. I don't think they really know what they're doing there, but they just feel good. And that's good enough reason to be there. And then he has this big bowl of lollies, you know, of sweets next to him. This enormous kind of bowl of sweets next to him. And then he has a little dipper, a little kind of bowl that he dips into this big bowl. And then he takes the sweets and he throws them out on the audience. At this point, I thought he was a little bit crazy here. But actually, no, you don't think that, because that sounds crazy. It sounds really strange. But when you are in the presence of the person like that, and you see this happening, actually, it is very natural. It is very ordinary. It seems actually very right. It is almost as if those sweets that he throws out, they symbolize the metta that he has in his heart. Because the metta is also sweet, in a way. And it's very natural. It's like if anyone else did that, if one started to throw out sweets on everyone, you would dismiss them. But because of the qualities of his heart, because the way he comes across, it's actually a beautiful little thing when that happens. And this is the power of people like this. They have something very hard to really, very intangible, untangible. You can't really, not really sure what it is. But it's something there that allows them to do things that other people cannot get away with. Yeah, and this is what is so beautiful about it. And then he has a long stick, and he blesses people in the audience. He has a long stick, and he kind of puts a stick on the head. Yeah, it looks really strange, but actually, it's also very sweet the way he does that, because the kindness and the goodness is so incredibly powerful. So eventually, I get the chance to ask him a question. I was very fortunate because I was Ajahn Brahm's disciple, so he gave me so much time. Everyone else, he didn't talk to very much at all, but he gave me special time. I was really fortunate. So he, you know, sat me down and he talked to me, and I asked him, how do you practice metta? Yeah, he's famous for his metta practice. How do you practice metta? And this is where it gets interesting, because what he said, that, well, this is how you practice metta. When you get up in the morning, you should ask yourself, what good can I do for the world today? What good can I do for the people who cross my path today? That was all he said. That was the end of his discourse on metta. So simple, so straightforward. And this is often why we don't make progress in Buddhism, because we forget the most basic things, the simple things. Metta is not something that you do in meditation. It can be something that you do in meditation, but it's much more what you do in your daily life, how you treat your fellow beings by body, by speech, and also by mind. That is the critical thing. And if you're able to get that right, then the path works out as a consequence. So this is the beauty of some of these things. When you come into presence of people like that, you have a feeling that Buddhism is still alive. It didn't die with the Buddha 2,500 years ago. It is still happening in the present day. There still is something powerful going on in the world. There are still people who realize these teachings in a profound way. That is the feeling you get. It's a very simple story. Nothing about supernormal powers, yeah? Nothing about flying through the air or nothing like that. To me, this is much more powerful than these other things. Okay, it would be nice if we could have Venerable Nisarananda, Venerable Dhammita flying through the air a little bit, but, you know, we're not going to ask that, because actually they would be breaking the precepts anyway if they did that. But the Buddha specifically says that he is disgusted by these supernormal powers. Why? Because they often get taken the wrong way. If you want to look it up, it's in the Kevada Sutta, Adiga Nikaya 11, the very beginning there. He talks about the jaguchi, which means disgust with the supernormal powers. And that, of course, is what the world looks for, rather than these much more subtle but much more profound indications of wisdom and power in people who have practiced the path a long way here. So that is one example. Another brief example I just want to mention very quickly, and this is another example. This is a story that Ajahn Brahm told me. This is a story when Ajahn Brahm was just after he had finished his fifth rains retreat, the Vassa, and that is when you kind of can go out on your own according to the Buddhist monastic code. So he went out and he traveled around Thailand, and he went to some of the very famous monasteries in Thailand, because Thailand has a certain area of Thailand where kind of most of the famous monks, all the famous monks live in this area. It's the most boring area of Thailand. It's interesting, isn't it? The best place to be a monastic is the most boring place. There's nothing else to do. You just have to sit down, close your eyes, and watch the breath. That was the most interesting thing to do there. So that's why. It's flat. There's all this field with tapioca. It was underdeveloped. There was nothing going on. It was utterly boring. So that's why so many people become monks. Now, it's actually much more difficult to become a monk because everyone has their iPhone or whatever else they have. It's much more. I'm sure it's a similar kind of situation sometimes if you look through the very long Sri Lankan history of Buddhism. So he went around to all these monks, and one of the monks that he went to was a monk called Ajahn Tate. And Ajahn Tate was very, very famous. Many people said he was an arahant at this time. And he had this big building that was built by him, by the king of Thailand. And these Thai buildings, if you have seen them, they're very beautiful, very ornate, with kind of gold and blue and these kind of things. It's a kind of special architecture they use in Thailand for buildings, for, you know, building halls and upasada halls and these kind of things. So this had been built for Ajahn Tate, and when Ajahn Brahm arrives at his monastery, he's told Ajahn Tate is in that hall. It's called the Mandapa in Thailand. So Ajahn Brahm goes to this hall. He opens up the door. He looks inside. Oh, nobody there. Okay, he goes again. And wait a minute. Actually, maybe there was someone in the corner. So he goes back again, opens the door, looks inside, and then he sees this old monk sitting in the far corner, far, far away. And then later on he realized the reason why he hadn't seen him was because this monk, he had so disappeared from the world. He had so little sense of self, so little ego, that he didn't really show himself to the world anymore. He doesn't say, here I am, yeah, I am here, look at me. Yeah, we have a certain need for being somebody, for being seen by others, for being recognized for who we are or whatever. We're all a little bit like that. But he was someone who had no need for recognition whatsoever. He was kind of merging with the wall. Yeah, he couldn't tell the difference between the monk and the wall. It was like almost kind of one thing. This is kind of nice, isn't it? Someone who has no ego, no sense of self. So Ajahn Brahm goes in. At this point, he wasn't Ajahn Brahm yet. He was just Venerable Brahm or whatever. He goes in and he comes to this monk, and he has all these questions that he wants to ask this monk, because this monk is so exceptional. But it's so beautiful to be in the presence of a person like that. It is so peaceful. A monk like that, there's no judgment. You feel completely at ease and completely free in the presence of a monk or a nun or anyone like that who has practiced the path all the way to the end, because there's no judgment anymore. You can be yourself. You can relax fully for the first time in your life. No one is going to judge you. So Ajahn Brahm sits down and he bows down to this very famous monk. Then his questions are gone. Because when you feel really relaxed and at ease, you can't think of the questions anymore. Yeah, questions are all gone. So he just sits down and he feels a bit foolish. Why are you here? Not sure. Yeah. Okay, well, hello, how are you? Oh, good. Yeah, how are you, Venerable Sir? Oh, yeah, pretty getting old now, but, you know, still okay. Yeah. Something like that. That's the conversation. Yeah, that's how you talk to arahants. Is that right? And it's strange, because meeting someone like that who is so powerful, actually it is the most relaxing, the most beautiful experience you can have, because you can really be at ease. You can be yourself. No judgment. Yeah, and this is why it's such a wonderful and beautiful occasion. And that is what Ajahn Brahm took away from that. The answer to the questions became irrelevant. Who cares about the questions if you can just have a glimpse of someone who has practiced the path probably all the way to the end? It is such a powerful experience in the own right. There's no need to ask any questions. So that was that experience. And I was going to say a few more things, but, you know, time is running out and it doesn't really matter. These are beautiful things. And sometimes I would recommend you to also think about the Buddha in a similar kind of way. When you see someone exceptional in the world, people have talked about now, remember the Buddha was probably a little bit like that. Very peaceful, non-judgmental, very deep, profound wisdom. It wasn't, you may think it might be frightening to approach the Buddha, but actually it wouldn't have been frightening at all. It would have been a very beautiful situation if you could do it. So think about the Buddha in the right way. And when you think about the Buddha in the right way, that too gives rise to this confidence and faith on the path that will give you this boost in your meditation practice and take you all the way to samadhi as a consequence. So this is the idea of faith. And you can see how what I'm saying now is that faith comes from hearing the good Dhamma, reading the suttas, and that the hearing the good Dhamma comes from Sampurisa Sangseva, which means associating with the good people, which are basically the Aryans, starting with the Buddha himself. When you associate with these people, you hear the Dhamma, faith arises. And that is what I have just described to you, how that process works. So, what does this mean? Well, it means that the very root of all these factors I've been talking about, I promised you to get down to the very root, yeah? At the very, very first factor. The very first factor is associating with the noble people, with the true people, with the Aryas in the world, with the Buddha first and foremost, but also with anyone else who has similar kind of qualities. That is the root thing, what we have to do to enable this whole process of awakening to happen, stage by stage by stage, as a consequence. So please make sure that you do that. Be discerning in how you listen to the Dhamma. Sometimes try to find inspiration in the word of the Buddha itself. Have maybe a copy of the Dhammapada on your night table, so you can open it up at a random page and read a few verses before you go to sleep. And then you sleep so nicely afterwards. And when you sleep well, you wake up in the morning energized, and then you carry on. Come back to these root teachings and allow them to inspire you. Listen to those people, monastics or other people, whoever it is, who give teachings that accord with these suttas, yeah, that are according to these things, and forget about all those additional things that sometimes you hear in the Buddhist world, and come back to the suttas to ensure that what you're hearing is the real Dhamma. And as you do that, this whole path starts to work. Yeah, it starts to work out by itself. You listen to the Dhamma, faith arises. When faith arises, you get the yoniso manasikara. Then you're able to fulfill the virtue and kindness as a consequence. Because the virtue and kindness is fulfilled when you practice the anapanasati. Easy. Breath in, breath out, bliss, joy, bang, samadhi. Leads to samadhi. And then eventually, when you keep on practicing the samadhi, eventually you too will become awakened as a consequence. This is how it works. All you have to do is to focus on the very first thing. Make sure you get a good dose of Dhamma at regular intervals. Make sure that Dhamma, be discerning about it. Make sure you get good Dhamma. Sometimes the Dhamma in the world is not really worthy of the name because it is just all discussions and conspiracy theories and all kind of stuff. Leave that aside. Come back to the basic fundamental teachings of the Buddha that progress you forward on this path. And the Buddha gave a very beautiful simile to explain this. I'm going to end up with a simile here. Otherwise I get told off from going over time. Actually, I can't imagine I would be told off. That's kind of very unlikely. But there's a beautiful simile in this particular sutta where the Buddha says that it is like the rain on a mountaintop. And the rain on the mountaintop, it rains and rains and rains on this mountaintop. And as it rains, the rain forms into little streams. And the little streams, they carry on down the mountainside, down and down. And as long as the rain keeps coming, those streams merge together into larger streams. As it keeps on raining, those larger streams go into the small lakes. If the rain keeps coming, the small lakes, they eventually overflow the banks and then carry on over the banks down to the larger lakes. If it keeps on raining on that mountaintop, eventually those larger lakes too will overflow. And when they overflow, they go into the large rivers. And if it keeps on raining, eventually that rain will reach all the way to the ocean. The raining on the mountaintop is the beginning. the reigning on the mountaintop is the reading, understanding the word of the Buddha, allowing the eye of the world. The Buddha is called the eye of the world because he sees first and he passes on the information to us, allowing us to be brainwashed by the eye of the world. Are you ready to be brainwashed? It's beautiful to be brainwashed. Yeah, make sure you choose the right teachings, and then brainwashing is great. So you allow the rain to come more and more. And as you do that, as you keep on investigating, reading the suttas, but read them wisely, don't read them stupidly. And as you do that, this whole path starts to work all by itself. And it works because it is so extraordinarily powerful. The confidence, the faith starts to arise. And then you start acting according to these powerful teachings as a consequence. All you have to do, keep the rain falling on that mountaintop. Yeah? As you do that, stage by stage by stage, eventually you obtain nibbana as a consequence. The ocean is nibbana. The ocean is awakening, is the end of that path. All you have to do is ensure the rain keeps coming down at the top. The easy path to awakening. Yeah? Make sure it rains. That's all you have to do. So that is the talk. So, and that is my message to people usually around the world. I talk about the same thing everywhere. Never say anything new. But that's good. Yeah, because we need to hear the same things, I think, many, many times. So keep on practicing like that. And if you do, you're going to go a long, long, long way on the path. I would like to add maybe that if you want to remember one word of Buddhism that is really not Buddhism, of Dhamma, that is really going to help you out on this path, one thing is coming back to the word of the Buddha, as I said now, and investigating it. Try to really understand it. Don't take it superficially. But if there's one word that you should remember at all times in your daily life, and if you can remember this one word, you're going to go a very, very long way on the path. That one word is kindness. If you can be kind at all times, moment after moment, day after day, the more you can do that, the better you can do it. You're going to have a tremendous success as a Buddhist and as someone who practices this path properly. Okay, that is all for now. I better stop now so we have a bit of time for questions as well. So there you are.
We received a few questions and we have typed it for him. So I'll first give these questions, and if there's time, facilitate. Okay, we'll first give these things if you have no objections.
Okay, it's the same thing.
Okay, very
this
good.
One is already answered, right, in the question number two.
Okay.
In a way, right?
I suppose, yes, we may can do that one quickly. Yeah, good, and I have the other questions as well. So I have, okay, good. Okay, so let's have a look at the questions that we have here. Is it the same thing, is it? Yeah, this one, okay. Okay, basically the same. Okay, good. So all the same. Okay, that makes life easier here. Okay, so let's have a look. So question number one. In the recent past, some people have been misled to believe that the best way to safeguard Buddhism is by resorting to hate speech and violence against people of other religions and ethnic communities, and are actively encouraging discrimination. Most Buddhists have been passive bystanders and are silent in the wake of this dangerous trend. Some say that this is Buddhist tolerance. Is this what tolerance means in Buddhism? What should followers of Buddha do at this particular time? According to the Buddha, what is the best way to safeguard Buddhism and live in harmony with people of other religions? Okay. So, the Buddha basically says that if other people do things that are not virtuous, that we should try to encourage other people to be virtuous. You may have seen this. This is actually one of the definitions of sila, of really good conduct in the suttas, is that not only should we be virtuous ourselves, but we should also encourage other people to be virtuous as well. So there is a right time if people get too upset or too angry and all of these kind of things. It is always good to try to kind of get them to their senses again and try to see things in a different way. A world that runs on anger is very quickly going to become a very difficult world, very violent, full of conflict and problems. So if we're able to get these emotions under control, it is much better if we can do that. So helping out, not being tolerant by just allowing things to be, but trying to make people come to their senses is obviously, it's a very positive thing here. But if you do so, you have to be wiser. You can't just tell people off and tell them you cannot be angry or whatever, because that often is going to backfire. You have to be very sensitive when you do these kind of things. You have to know the right time and place. Yeah, if someone is very angry, they're not likely to listen. So wait a little bit. Wait till it cool down a little bit. It's obvious that, you know, after the terrorist attacks that you had in Sri Lanka over Easter, this is a very big thing. It's almost like a national trauma in a sense in Sri Lanka. I know that because we had a similar kind of terrorist attack in Norway a few years ago, and I'm not sure if I'm Norwegian anymore. I used to be Norwegian in the old days, but now I'm kind of uncertain what I am. I'm kind of just floating somewhere between countries. I guess maybe I'm Sri Lankan right now. Maybe, possibly, anyway, it's uncertain. But we had a similar kind of thing, and it was very traumatic for the whole country when you had some madman, you know, shooting 70, 80 people, whatever, just for terribly stupid reasons. So sometimes you have to give people a little bit of a chance to cool down. It is kind of natural that people get a bit angry when these things happen. It's very difficult to have such control over your emotions that you don't get angry at all. So, you know, please also have a bit of compassion for those people who do get angry, because it is understandable that these things happen. But then at the right time and right place, remind them that actually this is not the best way forward. And the question here is a very good one. How do we safeguard Buddhism and live in harmony with other peoples of other religions? And the answer is, the way to safeguard Buddhism is not to counter-oppress or retort in the same way. The Buddha never said that revenge is a good idea. In fact, revenge is always a bad idea according to Buddhism. Hate never stops through hate in this world. Hate always stops through non-hate. This is an eternal law. Dhammapada number 5. Yeah, this is one of those fundamental verses in Buddhism. We know that this is not how the Buddha taught. And if we want to succeed in the Buddhist world, what we should do is follow the Buddha's example then of living with kindness, even when things are wrong. There's a famous place in the suttas where the lay people are slandering the Sangha and saying that the monastics are not doing the right thing. And the Buddha says to the Sangha, just relax, just let it be, don't do anything. In 7 days, everything will die down. And the same thing is true, regardless of how big the shock is for a country, regardless of how difficult it is to deal with, eventually it will die down and things will come back to normal again. All you have to do is to be a bit patient and things come back again as a consequence. One of the things to remember, one of the ways to learn tolerance in this world, is to remember that people are essentially the same, regardless of nationality, regardless of gender, regardless of age, regardless of education, regardless of intelligence, even regardless of religion. If you look into the heart of people, what you see are basically the same driving forces. We all want to be happy. We all want to avoid suffering. We all have these defilements in our mind. We are conditioned slightly differently, but in so many ways we are the same. And once you start to realize that, once you start to realize that the potential for being a terrorist and doing something bad is actually in all of us. As long as you have anger in your heart, as long as you haven't eradicated completely, given the wrong kind of conditioning, I could be a terrorist. I hope that's kind of a scary thought. Everyone can be a terrorist. That's the problem. Because the conditioning, given the wrong conditioning, the root causes of those terrorist acts are inside of the human heart. And once you start to see that, once you start to understand the universal nature of human beings, of our how we express ourselves, you cannot really get angry with other people anymore in quite the same way. If we had been born in a Muslim country, in here you are reborn in a country which is predominantly Buddhist, so you become a Buddhist, but what if you had been born in Pakistan? You'd probably be Muslim. Yeah, you probably wouldn't have much choice about it. All this conditioning, all of these things, is actually what makes us who we are. And the more we understand that, the more ability we have to look at other people as brothers and sisters. Brothers and sisters who sometimes are completely deluded, completely walking in the dark, who have no idea what they're doing, who are trying to find happiness in the world in exactly the wrong way. And once you understand that people actually are trying, they're looking for happiness, but what they are doing is causing suffering for themselves and others instead, then you start to have compassion, because you understand these people are just blind. They have no idea what they're doing. It's sad what they're doing here. Yeah, as I said before today, you want to give them a hug and say, calm down. It's okay. Please don't be a terrorist. Yeah, that is what you want to do, because they are on the wrong track. They need some metta, some loving kindness probably, because this is what they probably have been missing. That's why they ended up in such a dire strait in the first place. So this is one of the things that I often use as a reflection in my life, how we're all always changing. We're moving from one state to another one. We're moving from one nationality to another one, from one gender to another gender, especially between lives, from one life to the next one. Sometimes we're poor, sometimes we're wealthy, sometimes we're stupid, sometimes we're intelligent, sometimes we are everything, everything. But if all of those potentials are inside of you, if you have the potential to be reborn as that terrorist person in your next life, maybe not in your next life, but say many lives down the line, it takes a while before you get reconditioned. If your potential is inside of you to be all of these beings, how can we discriminate? How can we treat them so harshly if that is already inside of us? How can we discriminate against anyone in this world? How can we not see everyone in this world as our brother and sisters in a certain way? And in this way, you learn to be more tolerant, more understanding. You understand it's all about conditioning ultimately. That is the only difference. There's this beautiful sutta where the Buddha says that we have been reborn so many times that almost all the beings that we meet in the world have been our mother, our father, our sister, our brother, our son, and our daughter. So when you look at the people around you, whether they are Buddhist, Christians, Muslims, atheists, Martians too, yeah. Everyone, all beings in this world. It's a bit hard to be kind of the sister or brother of a Martian, but you know, everyone in the world, we have had these relationships too. So imagine yourself being the mother of this person. How would you feel? You would be sad that they acted like that, but you would be able to forgive, because that is the power of being a mother. You can usually forgive what your children do. So this is the right attitude in Buddhism. And when we can do that, when we can forgive even such atrocities, then we are on the right track. Then what we can do, the next step then, is to try to solve the root of the problem. Why do these things happen? And once we look for solving the root of the problem, at least we can solve it partially. We can do something to lead in the right direction. Instead of going to war, instead of fighting, leading to more fighting, endless fighting. This is what the world is like, endless fighting, revenge upon revenge upon revenge, going round and round and round. And it's such a waste, and it's so much suffering, and so incredibly problematic. We need to be a bit wiser how we deal with these things. So the way to safeguard Buddhism is to live the Buddhist teachings. Because when you live the Buddhist teachings, people get inspired by that. They think, wow, these Buddhists, they are amazing. Even when life is so difficult and problems are so harsh, still they have the ability to be kind, to be compassionate to the world around them. What a beautiful example that is. And I can tell you from first experience, because I live in Australia, that when Buddhists get it wrong, and sometimes everyone gets it wrong sometimes, Buddhists included. And the example now is the example from Myanmar, where sometimes the Buddhists really went overboard, as far as I could see, in terms of discriminating against the Muslims, and that really went too far. That was just my perspective anyway. It looks like that has very bad repercussions in the Western world when the Buddhists are seen to do the wrong thing. Buddhism has, generally speaking, Buddhism has an incredibly good name around the world, and we have to be careful to sully the name of Buddhism by getting into tit-for-tat kind of thing and taking revenge. All we're doing is destroying the good name of Buddhism and then destroying its potential for being a source for good in the world. That is what happens in these situations. Okay. So let's go on to the third question. Siddhartha Gautama left his infant son seeking enlightenment. I find it difficult or even wrong to leave my old mother, who needs me, to travel the path he showed. Kindly discuss. Yes, this is actually an interesting question. And I have been told that sometimes, you know, sometimes you have people who want to convert Buddhists from Buddhism to Christianity, and they use this argument and saying, the Buddha, he was no good. Yeah, he just left his son. How can you believe in a Buddha like that? You can't just leave your son behind like that. You know, he's just born. That is kind of, that's, and because, and the reason for that is because sometimes what we do, we haven't read the suttas, understood the word of the Buddha properly. Because that is actually just the legend of the Buddha. The legend of the Buddha is that he leaves the palace, he gets onto the horse Kantaka, he has a last look at his wife and son, and then he rides off and jumps over the wall and becomes a monk or whatever later on. But that is actually not what the suttas. This is a later legend. This is the mythology of the Buddha. And we need to be very careful in Buddhism to distinguish between mythology on the one hand and what actually the Buddha said on the other hand. This is found in a book called the Jataka Nidana, which is the source of the Jataka stories. This is much later than the early suttas of the Buddha. What the Buddha says is actually quite different. If you read one of his autobiographical sutta, where the Buddha talks about his own life, what he says is that when I decided to go forth, yeah, my parents were crying and wished otherwise. Well, if his parents were crying and wished otherwise, he would have had to consult with them. He would have talked to them. He wouldn't have ridden off in the middle of the night. That's pretty obvious. Yeah. So his parents wished otherwise, but he still decided because it was obviously an important thing. So from that, I think we can deduce fairly clearly he had discussed it with his family, discussed it with his parents, ensured that his wife and son would be looked after in a proper way. There wasn't any problem. It was a wealthy family. Yeah, they had probably good people to look after them and all of these kind of things. That is the real story behind the Buddha's awakening here. So that is what you should take as your example when it comes to your elderly mother. If you want to go forth, you should ensure that she is looked after in one way or another. Yeah, you should not just leave her and say, well, if you live or die, that's your problem. I'm joking, yeah. If you live or die, that's your problem. That would be a terrible thing to do. Yeah, and especially considering all the debt of gratitude we have to our parents and all of that. Of course, you have to look after her. If you look after her, if you know that she will be looked after properly, especially if you get her permission and she says, yes, of course, I want you to be able to go forth. It's such a wonderful thing to do that. Please do so. You have my blessing here. If you treat it in the good, right way, it is likely you will get your parents' blessing. Even my parents gave me my blessing to go forth. I was only just, yeah, it was only because it's difficult to let go of your children, yeah, it's very hard, and especially when you come from a non-Buddhist culture, you have no idea what Buddhism is, really, really difficult. But if you do it in the right way, usually it works out. So that is the right way of doing it. And if you can do it in that way, it's good. But if it is too difficult, you cannot just leave your mother alone without proper care. That it would not be appropriate. And the Buddha really showed the way as far as I can see here. So we have a few minutes left. So if anyone would like to ask any questions or whatever, please do so. Or if you have some disagreement with what I said, you're more than welcome to mention that as well. So please... please don't be shy to ask him.
If you have any questions, I can get the mic.
Teruvan Sarnai. Thank you, Ajahn, for coming to do a wonderful teachings to us. I have one question. Most of people are getting discouraged because some teacher says we are not fulfilled paramita to attain to Nibbana. And this time it is very difficult, and some people are getting discouraged. And is it true? Please advise on that. That is my first question. And the second one, is there any fully enlightened monks around?
Okay. I can ask the second one first of all. Don't think like that. Because it's not really a very suitable. If I said, yes, there are, would you just believe me, or would you inquire further? There is no end to that kind of questioning. Yeah, it doesn't end there. It goes on and on and on. So what you should do instead is you should just look for good qualities in the people. And if you see good qualities, you can place a bit of faith there. And the more you see of good qualities, the more faith you can place, a confidence in that person. That is really the right way. And ultimately, you never really know, so place faith in a broad category called the Sangha. That's why we place faith in the Sangha rather than individuals. Yeah, of course, there will be some individuals that are more faith-inducing than others, but that's the general attitude you should have. So just look for the good qualities. And then when you see the good qualities, that is the right way of having faith. As for the paramis, again, the paramis is a development in Buddhism. Came a long time after the Buddha. There's no mention of paramis in the suttas. It is mentioned a couple of ways, but is used in a completely different way in the suttas, not in the way of the bodhisattva who fulfills paramis. This is a much later development. In fact, it was pointed out by one scholar, it was probably a Theravadan response to Mahayana, because the Mahayana started to have bodhisattvas. Yeah, and the Theravadan thought, we don't have bodhisattvas. Well, we have to kind of keep up with the Joneses, yeah? Okay, so they have bodhisattvas, so we better also have a bodhisattva path. So then we have to make it slightly different. Okay, Mahayana had 6 paramis, we had 10 paramis, yeah? Something like that. That was his point, because it looks like these things arose later in Theravada than they did in Mahayana. They got nothing to do with the word of the Buddha. The Buddha never said that if you haven't got certain qualities, you can't become enlightened. There's nothing like that in the suttas. There's only one thing that is required, and we still have the teaching here. If we have the teaching of the Buddha, if we have the Noble Eightfold Path, then you can still go all the way to full awakening in this life. And to be honest with you, the evidence that we still have the teaching of the Buddha is very, very good. And we know that for many, many reasons, but one of the reasons we know that is because these suttas that we have, they have been kept also in other schools of Buddhism. Some of them have been translated into Chinese, into Tibetan, into all these languages. These suttas have been apart for 2,300 years, all the way back to the time of Ashoka. And if you compare them now, the similarities are enormous. All the basic things in Buddhism are there, despite its enormous separation. So we can be pretty, really, really sure that what we have is still the word of the Buddha. I don't think there's much doubt about that. So everything points to the fact that the Dhamma is still alive. And so personally, I have no doubt. And when you see some of these people that you meet, you think, wow, Dhamma is definitely alive. So look out for those people. Okay.
Venerable sir, is premarital sex a sin in Buddhism, and does one go to hell? And my second question is, how does one actually practice the third precept?
Okay. Is it a sin in Buddhism? Well, the third precept in Buddhism is about not having any kind of sexual relations that hurt other people. Yeah, that is what it is about. So you have to ask yourself whether you are hurting somebody. And obviously, there are many obvious things that are not appropriate for that straight away. You know straight away when you're hurting somebody in the wrong way. And generally speaking, you would say that in these days, for example, being unfaithful in a marriage would be considered inappropriate, because so much hurt happens when the husband or wife is unfaithful to the husband or wife. Yeah, it's so difficult to take. And a lot of breakup of marriages and a lot of heartache comes before that. When it comes to premarital sex, I don't think it is absolute one way or the other. I would say it depends a little bit on a culture, for example. Yeah, it depends a little bit on the situation. But generally speaking, it is a difficult question to answer. But I think that in a society where people don't consider it a problem, yeah, it is not a problem, because you're not hurting anyone if you do it. In a society which is very conservative, and that is considered looked down upon, and maybe you hurt your parents very, very badly if you do it or something like that, then of course it is more grayish, it's more difficult to kind of to say it with absolute certainty. So it depends on the situation, depends on the relationship. The main thing is that you don't want to hurt other people with what you're doing here. And that is really where it comes down to. But I don't think, generally speaking, there is an absolute barrier or problem in that particular area. Okay. Anything else? Oui.
Thank you very much for coming for Sri Lanka. It's been your precise time. I have two questions regarding the one question is with regard to the Satara Satipatthana, the last one, what we call the Dhammanupassana, is same as Vidarshana.
Vidarshana, okay.
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
The other one is, so what is the difference between the tranquility and the joy?
difference between tranquility and joy here?
Yes. Tranquility and the joy. Ooh. When you are doing the anapanasati, so you will get joy, and after that you have to tranquility, and you have to renounce your body and everything.
Yeah.
So just,
what was the relation to dharma and upasana? What was the relationship?
Vidarshana.
Yeah, what was the question with that?
The first one is what is the I'm asking the dhammanupassana is the same as what we call vidarshana.
Ah, okay, I see. Yeah, okay, good. Okay, so let me take the second question first about tranquility, samatha, and joy. Yeah, what is the relationship between samatha and joy, roughly? The answer to that is that when samatha deepens, joy tends to arise as a consequence of the peace. Yeah, because if you are really getting peaceful, it is very, you have to enjoy it. If you're getting really peaceful, it's very enjoyable, especially if you have mindfulness. If you fall asleep and you're peaceful, not so good. But if you have mindfulness and you're peaceful, usually joy often comes along. Yeah. So the idea here, and if it doesn't come along, then you use some of the techniques given by the Buddha to help to give rise to joy. You use the Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati, you use Chaga Nusati. These are all techniques to help you arise joy on the path. So for the meditation to become really powerful, there's two things that you have to have in samatha: calm and happiness. And both of these factors have to be developed. Yeah? The more peaceful you are, and the more happy you are, the deeper is your samatha. You cannot have one without the other. Both of those have to come together. And only when they come together are they fit for deep samadhi experience. The more powerful the peace, the more subtle and refined and beautiful your happiness, the more deep is your samadhi. This is how they go together. As for the other question, the dhammanupassana, it is very easy to, one place to look at it from is to look at it from the place of the Anapanasati Sutta. If you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, the main emphasis, the 16 steps, yeah, Anapanasati Sutta, the main emphasis on the first 12 is on the watching the breath and calming down. You get to the number 12, it's called Vimochayang Chittang, liberating the mind, that's kind of entering Samadhi or Jhana. And the last four are called Anicca-nupassana, Viraga Nupassana, Nirodha Nupassana, and Patinissaga Nupassana. That's the last four. That is all about Anupassana, looking on, and all about Anicca Viraga. In other words, it's about insight. Yeah? It's quite obvious from the Anapanasati Sutta. So, and that is equivalent to Dhamma Nupassana. So the last part of Satipatthana is mostly about insight. And if you read the categories there, it's very obvious that is the case. But one of the important points to remember about meditation practice is that any meditation practice that works leads to two things, both samatha and vipassana. So even when you do the dhammanupassana, if it does lead to insight, it will also lead to calm. Calm and insight are two sides of the same coin. They always have to go together. Yeah? So you can focus a bit on one, or focus a bit on the other one, but there are two aspects of the mind that arise together. Why? The reason is because the thing that stops you from getting calm are the five hindrances. The five hindrances or defilements drive you into the future, drive you into the past, to stop you from calming down. The thing that stops you from having insight, or vidarshana or vipassana, if you use the Pali word, is exactly the same thing. It is the defilements that stop you from having insight. Yeah? Because when you have defilements in the mind, that you have a vested interest, you have a bias in the mind, you can't see things clearly. So by reducing the defilements, you get both samatha and vipassana. They have the same problem as the root. Reduce the problem, they both arise as a consequence. So they are two sides of the same kind of mental quality, if you like. Yeah. So, okay, good.
Venerable Thero, at the end of your Dhamma talk, you advise all of us to practice kindness. So, something that happens quite often, especially in today's world, is the exploitation of kindness. So what is the Buddhist way in the sense, do you keep turning your other cheek as well?
That's Christianity.
Or, how do we preserve a little bit of dignity as well while practicing kindness? Thank you.
Okay, very good. Turning the other cheek, that's from the Bible. Yeah, so don't. But the answer to that is that, yes, you're right. So you have to be a bit circumspect. You have to be a bit careful. Don't be indiscriminately kind if you know it's going to be taken advantage of. Yeah, don't be silly about it. You have to use wisdom. Wisdom always comes with all of these things. The most important thing is to have kindness inside of you, in your heart. That's the most important thing. Yeah? Whether you show it externally or not will depend on the circumstance. Yeah, when you feel it is the right time, if it is your family members, your friends, for example, colleagues at work who you trust, etc., then you can be kind. Then you can do it in the right way. Yeah. If you feel that it's going to be taken advantage of, if it's the wrong kind of people, maybe even colleagues at work, I don't know what kind of colleagues you have, I have no idea. If you think it's going to be taken advantage of, have it in your heart. Understand that this is the way they are because of cause and conditions. They don't really want to be like this. They probably want to be kind. Everybody wants to be kinder. We know that kindness leads to happiness. So have kindness in your heart, but don't express it in a way whereby you get taken advantage of. When you have the chance to be kind, to do a little act because you feel safe, then do it. But don't do it at times when you feel that it is difficult or it is going to go the wrong way. Yeah. Is that sufficient? Yeah? Okay, very good. Yeah.
I must say, my question is going to be something different from the questions that were asked earlier. Mm. I was writing some notes from my family, what to do when I am ill and cannot communicate, and I know I am going to die.
Yeah.
And so I started the usual thing of, do not put me on life support, do not perform surgery on me, and do not force feed me. And my thinking was that death is natural. I should let it take place. I do not want my life prolonged. Mm. And therefore, do not make me suffer. Mm. Then it occurred to me that if death is natural, so is suffering. And I have no right, really, to tell my families, don't do this, don't do that. Let them do it. And I should just not try to impose myself on them. Mm. But I would like to know, am I thinking right?
I don't know, because the answer is that we always treat each other in various ways. We always impose on each other in various ways. But that's just part of parcel of being human beings. And we always try to help each other. We all want to be compassionate to each other. So really what you're doing is you're giving your children and your family a chance to be compassionate towards you. Yeah, you said, this is what I would like to do. And if you are going to be compassionate towards me, then this is the way I would like you to treat me at the end. And that's okay. You are allowed to kind of tell them what your preferred way of compassion is. So when it comes to the end of your life, then your children or whoever's going to make a decision, they have to then look and then have to ask themselves whether those conditions are fulfilled. Yeah, and if they feel that you have changed your mind in the meantime, of course, then they shouldn't do it. That's when they do something wrong. But if they feel that that is still in your mind, you still agree with this, maybe they even ask you, maybe you're able to, you're still kind of alive enough to blink one eye or something like that. You've seen those people who wrote a book by blinking one eye. Yeah, it's kind of that kind of stuff. So say blink twice if you want to say no, blink once if you want to say yes or something. Then it's okay. Yeah. So I don't think we should. There's no need to extend things needlessly and to suffer needlessly. And it's okay to kind of have that sort of demands on our. It's not really a demand. It's just a natural telling them what to do, so that they feel more at ease when they can make these kind of life and death decisions at the end of life, really.
Karanya mata kusalena yantam santam padam abhisamecha sako uchu cha suchu cha suvacho cha samudu anatimani santu sako cha subaro cha apakisho sallahu kavutti Santindriyo cha nipako cha abhagabho kulesu ananugidho nachakudha samachare kinchiyena vinyu pare upavadeyo sukhino vakhemino hantu sabe sata bhavantu sukhitata yeke chipana bhutati tasava dhavarava anavase sadhigavaye maha Asaka akakula dita vayeva adita yeshadure vasanti avidure bhutava sambhavesiva sabe sata avantu sukhitata aparo param nikubesa Atimanye sakata shinanganji Vyarosana patighasanya Nanyamanya sadukhamichaya Mataya taniyamputa Ayusa ekaputa manurake Evam visababhutesu manasambhavaye aparimana metancha sabalokasmin manasambhavaye aparimana unang adrocha thiriyancha sambhadang averang Asabhata Dityan Chakpaginava Svayano Haryavata Savigatamiyo Etaṃ Satyaṃ Adhitteya Brahma Metaṃ Viharaṃ Idamahudhitinja Anupagamasilava Dāsanena sampāno kāme suvineya gedha Nāyujātu gābhaseya punaretiti
Sādhu, 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 sādhu